Part 5, Maximum Selling Strategies. As you know, I work as a marketing consultant and a strategic planner for large and small companies nationally and internationally. I get paid an enormous amount of money to share these ideas and to help executives and salespeople think through these ideas and how they might apply to their work. Sometimes very small changes in your perception of what you do and who you do it with can lead to dramatic increases in your effectiveness. So let's start off with part 5, your ability to sell yourself and your ideas to others will determine how high you rise and how much money you make. Now, if you're not concerned about money, well, give it to your favorite charity, but at least earn it in the first place. As Abraham Lincoln said, the very best way to help the poor is not to become one of them. And the point is this, is that we are all in the business of selling, as I pointed out. We're all in the business of persuading, communicating, influencing. And I used to think, because I was told as a young man, dangerous belief, if you're a big talker, gift of the gab, you can be successful in selling. Well, as it is, there are an enormous number of people who are great talkers who are not successful in selling because it's all just blah, 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 blah. Then we find, surprise, surprise, psychographically, 75% of the highest paid salespeople are officially classified as introverts. They are not aggressive, outgoing, outspoken, fast-talking people. They're low-key, they're friendly, they ask good questions, they focus in on the customer's situation and then show the customer how his or her life could be improved in a cost-effective way, and they outsell the fast-talkers 3-to-1. So don't ever think that because you are not a fast talker or a loud talker or an extroverted person, that for any reason you're held back in being successful in persuasion and communication and negotiating. Very, very interesting. I could tell you all kinds of research on it, but just accept that it's true, is that you can become absolutely excellent at selling yourself and your ideas without changing your personality at all. Now, I said I would give you parts of my philosophy as we went through the days. And here's another part. I gave you my part a little bit earlier, is that no one is better than you and that you are thoroughly good. And the acceptance of that is very, very important. The second thing that I will tell you is that you do not have to be different from who you are. You just have to be all of who you are. You have to be more of who you are. But you don't have to be someone other than who you are. You are unique in all the world. There has never been someone just like you. The odds are 50 billion to one genetically that there will ever be two people like yourself. They'll ever look like you, think like you, feel like you. Did anybody see the movie Multiplicity with Michael Keaton? They had a very interesting observation that even if they made a perfect clone, because of the experiences that person would begin to have from that moment, they would begin to become a different person. So even if they cloned you perfectly, within a couple of weeks, that perfect clone would start to be different from you. Even twins that start off literally coming from the identical cell, same chromosomes, genes, and everything else, change and develop their personality. So you don't need to be different from who you are because what you are is fantastic. It's unique. It's special. It's the most incredible creation in the history of the universe. There can never be two like you, like a snowflake. So therefore, you don't need to be different. You don't need to look at someone else and say, I wish I was like them. Don't need to be like them. You need to be more like you because what you are is all that you possibly could need to be to have a wonderful life, and it's all you have because you cannot be other than who you are. So never try. Never try to be different from who you are. When I was a young man, I got into relationships with members of the opposite persuasion where I was enamored, and I tried to change myself. And throughout my youth, I tried to change myself to be more like what I thought other people would find more acceptable. And we've all been in that situation because if you're a normal person, you want to be liked and to be accepted by others. So often we try to twist ourselves a bit like a pretzel so that we are more likable. But what happens is we twist ourselves to the point where we're no longer ourselves, but simultaneously we've entered that never-never land where we're not the person that the other person wants either. We're neither. We're nothing. And the answer is to get back to being just the very best you that you can be. And choose the line of least resistance in that you please at least yourself in all things. Be your own person in all things. Well, this brings us to maximum selling strategies. And looking at your product or service, ask, what exactly do you sell? What exactly do you sell? Is there anybody here who sells homes in real estate? Many people think in real estate that they sell homes. Is that true?
No.
It's a part truth. It's a partial truth because that's where the money comes from. But the question is, can anybody else sell the same home you're selling? Can 1,000 people sell the same home you're selling, identical, same price, same term, same location? Of course, it's on the MLS. So therefore, if a person is going to buy the home, they're buying something else. What is it? Of course. Of course. They're buying the uniqueness of the purchasing experience with you accompanying it. Other than that, they get it from someone else. You've all had experiences where you have found a product or service you liked, and then you went to someone that you liked to buy from. You didn't want to get it from the person who may even have convinced you that you should get it. You wanted to get it from someone else. The person who comes with the experience is critical. So, what exactly do you sell? And it's always from the viewpoint of the other person. From the other's viewpoint. What is the other's viewpoint? Number two, is A, people buy benefits, not products. People buy how they anticipate feeling in the future. So the very best salespeople don't talk about the product and what it is. They talk about the product and what it does in terms of improving the life or work of the other person. Amateur salespeople always talk features. Professionals always talk benefits. Amateurs talk about it, what it is today. Professionals talk about what it does for the customer tomorrow. B, people buy solutions, not services. The old saying is that people do not buy a Black & Decker quarter-inch drill, they buy a quarter-inch hole. The drill is just the means to getting the hole. And it's important to understand because we become preoccupied, all of us. And by the way, the reason I am so enthusiastic about it, the things I tell you, is I've learned them all the hard way. I've made every mistake countless times. So when I say this is a better way to do it, I've learned. I've got blood under my fingernails. And we get so preoccupied with selling our product, we don't realize that what the customer wants is a solution to his or her problem. And your job in selling is to identify the problem clearly. Accurate diagnosis is half the cure. C is people buy to satisfy needs. So taking the time to determine the solution to the problem for which you have a solution, and the needs that the customer has are the key to selling. And let me talk about this more as we go along. Now, two, people have two major motivations. You know what they are? That's right. A is desire for gain. And B is fear of loss. We have found throughout history that we are all motivated to improve our condition. That every human act is taken to improve our condition or to avoid our condition deteriorating. Sigmund Freud called this the pleasure principle. We move toward pleasure and we move away from pain. And in psychology, we say we move toward comfort and away from discomfort. And so therefore, the very best is to use both of these in every sale, is incorporate both into every presentation. Show how the person can be better off with your product or service, or simultaneously show how they might be worse off if they don't have your product or service now. If you can show them both, and when I do selling consulting, I say, let's write down all the reasons why a person would benefit, and let's write down all the losses or detriments that a person would experience if they didn't buy this product from you at this time. And think about it, and you may find that there's just one factor that is a critical factor. Maybe they're going to buy it anyway, but the cost will be higher. Maybe they're going to buy it anyway, but the choice will be smaller. Maybe they're going to buy it anyway, but if they don't do it now, it'll take much longer and cause much more trouble later. You can sometimes find a critical loss that will cause a person to act now. Number three is there are three parts of selling, which we've talked about before. Prospecting, 3A. Prospecting is the first. You prospect, and the quantity determines the quality. There are two exceptions with regard to this. If you sell a product for whom there is a large market, thousands of people can buy it and use it, photocopiers, cellular telephones, and things like that, then your sales success is determined by the quantity of people that you talk to. If you sell a product for which there is a narrow market and there are only a few customers within your market area, then the quality of the planning that goes into your prospecting is the critical factor. Large possible market population, see as many people as possible. Small possible market population, identify and plan each of those customer contacts strategically, because you can't afford to blow even one. I worked for the division of Xerox in San Diego, and it was the corporate division of Xerox that manufactures the massive multi-copiers, two-sided color collators. They're virtually small printing presses. They only had 6 customers in San Diego. When San Diego is the 6th largest city in the United States, there are only 6 major potential customers for this division. Every one of those customers had to be storyboarded on the wall. Key people, almost like a mafia sting, where you put all the key people, the bosses, the underbosses, the capos, and so on. They had to work out who's under who reports to who makes decisions. Every single corporate client was a major client, and they were worth $2 or $3 million a year in sales. But they didn't just rush out and knock on the door and say, hey, you got anybody here who wants big photocopy machines? They were very careful. They found out the clubs the people belonged to. They went through their chain of contacts. Who do you know who knows somebody who knows somebody? They approached each of the clients, and while the other companies ran at them like dogs chasing a car down the street, Xerox's people just pulled back, planned a strategy, and then moved in on these companies, and they got 5 of the 6 and locked them in and had them for years. And the other company was still running around the parking lot going, ruff, 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 and wondering why they got beat out. Okay, B is present. And B, presenting, is of course where you ask questions and you discuss your product or service. Now, presenting is the inner game of selling. Your ability to make a persuasive presentation, which goes from the general to the particular, which logically proceeds to the inevitable and inescapable conclusion that this is the right product or service for them, the presentation is a real mark of the pro. And what is a good presentation based on? Also starts with P, 5th quality of the most successful salespeople. Preparation, sir, you're right. Preparation is the mark of a good presentation. Not a canned presentation, but a presentation that is very carefully thought out and written out and laid out for this particular customer based on what they've told you. One of the things that we found, and this may be applicable to you or not, is what is called the 2-call sell. The first call is solely to position yourself as a consultant and to ask good questions and to get a very good understanding of the client's situation and to build rapport with the client so they know you and like you and trust you. Then you say, I think I have enough information. I would like to get back to you at a later time and go over some recommendations with you if that would be all right with you, because I think we can help you in a cost-effective way. 99 times out of 100, they'll say sure. Then you set up a second meeting, and in the second meeting, you have now prepared your presentation. Based on what the customer has told you, you repeat it and reiterate it and walk through it logically to the inescapable conclusion that what you have is exactly what they need to take the next step in their life and career. But the preparation is critical. It's so flattering to be with a sales professional who's obviously prepared, and it's so frustrating to be with a salesperson who's winging it and pulling out price lists and brochures as the presentation goes on. So the presentation is critical, and C is the follow-up. Now, the follow-up is important. Remember, it's 20% of the process, because the average sale is closed on the 5th call. 50% of customers are only seen once. Almost all initial sales conversations end without even a request for a subsequent meeting. They say, well, what do you think so far? Well, I think I'd like to think it over. Okay. Well, you think it over, and we'll get back together sometime. Okay. Okay. Well, you think it over, and I'll think it over, and we'll think it over, and I'll call you, and we'll call each other, and we'll keep in touch. Great. What do you think about? Great. Boy, have I got a lot of hot prospects on the hook. No, you don't. You don't have anything. As a matter of fact, if you called that person back today, they will have forgotten you ever lived. But follow-up is very important, and there's 2 questions that you can ask, and they're not in here, but I will give them to you. One question, if it's clear that you cannot make a sale at the end of this call, but it's also clear that you are singing off the same page of the hymn book that there is a very good reason for you to proceed in this relationship. What you have, what they have, and so on. A very good question is, I think we've made a lot of progress here. How would you like to proceed now? I think we can be very helpful to you. I think from what you've told us, we have something that would be very useful to you. How would you like to proceed now? Very simple question that will probably generate a very telling response. Well, I think we should get back together again and look at how we can use this. Or I think you should take the information you have and put together a proposal for me. Or I think you should work out some numbers. In other words, very often they will tell you what they want you to do. If they tell you what they want you to do, what is your likelihood of making a sale when you do it? It's very high. It's not guaranteed, but it's very high. So what would you, ideally, I think we've made a lot of progress. I think we can be of great help to you. What would you ideally like to do now? And very often, they will often say, well, I'd like to purchase it. I mean, I think we should just go ahead with it. Very often, they'll just close. But at the very least, you always ask for what is called an advance. I would like to set up a subsequent meeting with you at a specific time and date to take this to the next stage. When would be convenient? I'll be out here again next Thursday afternoon. Would sometime Thursday afternoon be okay for you? Old school thinking. Would you prefer it Wednesday morning at 10 or Thursday at 2? If you ever say that sort of a thing, you insult your client because it's a joke in selling. You just say, would Wednesday morning be better for you or Thursday afternoon? But don't give the specific times because it's so old that it's embarrassing. Just treat your customer the way you'd like them to treat you and say, I'll be in this area Thursday morning and Wednesday morning and Thursday afternoon. So follow up. Remember, don't be afraid to follow up as long as the customer does not discourage you. If the customer says, I don't need it, I don't want it, I can't use it, and I can't afford it, thanks for coming in anyway, don't keep going back to that person because you think you're supposed to be persistent. That's not a good sign. The first meeting will probably give you a very good indication of whether or not this is worth pursuing. But if it's worth pursuing and the customer suggests you do this and the customer is willing to set up a subsequent meeting with you, this is good. This is good. Then you keep advancing the sale. Recognize that it'll probably be the third or fourth or fifth sale before you'll actually put it together. Number four is there are three stages of the sale from the salesperson's perspective. This is called the selling process. And it is basically, first of all, establish rapport. Now, it's important that this part of the process be done in sequence. In our examination of tens of thousands of sales calls, we have found that if you sell out of sequence, you will kill the sale. It's very much like a combination lock. If you have a combination lock and you have the right numbers, but you turn the numbers in the wrong sequence, what will happen? Nothing. You might as well not even have the right numbers, right? But if you turn to the right numbers in the right sequence, even a child can open the lock. We have found we can take salespeople and dramatically increase their sales simply by getting them to sell in the proper sequence. And the first part of the sequence is establishing rapport. Now, how do you establish rapport? Conversation. By asking questions. You ask questions. Now, there's two types of questions you can ask, and this is what the research tells us. The first type of question is what all salespeople ask. It's the personal question. How are you? How long have you lived in San Jose? Are you married? Do you have any children? How long have you worked here? And so on and so forth. The personal question is very interesting because we love to talk about ourselves, but it has a great detriment. It has a great weakness. What is it?
It doesn't get to the point.
It doesn't get to the point, and it does not present any benefit for me, the customer, to tell you what I already know about myself. I enjoy telling you, but I'm not getting anything out of this. However, questions that are aimed at the situation, the customer's situation, are helpful because they help the customer to think better about where he or she is and where he or she is going. So a question such as, what are you doing in this area now? And how is that working for you? And where do you expect to be in 2 or 3 years? And how will your needs be different at that time? And what steps would you be thinking of taking between now and then so you stay ahead of the curve? These are very helpful questions. When we start talking about goal setting, you will find that the very act of writing out goals in a sequence that we'll discuss is enormously helpful to you. It's enormously enriching, as a matter of fact, to be able to be helped to think through who you are and where you're going. And that's what you want to do with customers, is you want to help them clarify their situation. Once you've established rapport, there's a nice natural time where the sales conversation just shifts neatly into a higher gear, and the customer will often say, well, what you got? Or, well, why don't you tell me a little bit about what you have? Or, in other words, it'll shift naturally into the next phase. You don't have to jump into it. And that is identifying the problem. And identifying the problem is also done with questions. And the whole purpose of the questions is to find what is called the gap. You in selling are in the business of gap analysis. What is gap analysis? You are looking for a gap between where the customer is today and where they could be with your product or service. If there's no gap, there's no sale. If the customer is perfectly complacent and perfectly satisfied, or your product or service offers only a tiny improvement over their existing situation, there's no possibility there. When you speak to a customer for the first time, by the way, the problem is one of three kinds. It is clear, it is unclear, or it's non-existent. That's why you position yourself as a consultant. Because when you speak to a person for the first time, you're a nice, intelligent, personable person. When you speak to them for the first time, they may look like a prospect, but they may not be at all. So therefore, you don't approach them as if they're a customer. You just simply ask them questions to determine whether or not there is a problem that they're clear about, or maybe there's a problem that they're unclear about, or maybe they don't have a problem at all. And if you're honest, every so often, when you finish talking to a customer, you will say, you know, based on what you've told me, there's really nothing I can do to help you at this time. You seem to be well positioned. You seem to be in good shape. You have the right products, services, equipment that you need. And I wouldn't lie to you and tell you that you need something more than you have. I think you're very well positioned. In the future, you may need something more or better, and I would like the opportunity to keep in touch with you, you know, over the coming months and just make sure that you remain as satisfied as you are. You don't have any massive changes in your needs. Telling a customer that you can't help them is a powerful way to get referrals. Because then you can say, and by the way, do you know anyone else, based on what we just talked about, who might be able to use what I sell? And often the customer will say, well, as a matter of fact, I can't, but I know someone else who is where I was 6 months ago and might be a great prospect. And sometimes you will find that your best customers will come from people who never buy at all. Because you treat them so well, they want you to treat their friends as well. So don't be afraid to ask. It's called the golden chain. And the third part is to present the solution. And you present the solution by basically we say show, tell, and ask questions. This is the presentation part. You show, tell, and ask questions. So if you take this little process here, where should the price enter into the conversation? Where should it become an issue? And the answer is here. Somebody said it at the end. This is where the price comes in. Why is that? This question, by the way, is critical to your success. It's the major reason why salespeople fail. Why? Tanya, you're absolutely right. If they don't want it, if they have not been brought to a critical mass of understanding, so they say, I want that. I like that. That's good. That sounds makes a lot of sense. Then the price is irrelevant. However, if you do bring the price in too early, like they'll often say at the beginning, how much is it? You must avoid the price if you can. Now, if your price is written and it's clear and so on, then they're not going to ask how much it is because the price is written all over everything. But if the price is variable, if you sell a product or service that may have more or less in it, it may cost different things, put off the price. One of the best ways of dealing with price is just to say, I don't know. How much is it? I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Don't know. I don't know. Well, Mr. Prospect, quite honestly, I'm not even here to sell you anything. I see myself more as a consultant. And until I ask you a couple of questions, I have no idea whether or not this would even be helpful to you. But if I could ask you a couple of questions, I could give you an answer that's accurate to within a dollar or two. For example, I would need to know. And you start into a questioning sequence. Why is it that the best salespeople, like the best trial lawyers, seem to ask such excellent questions so beautifully sequenced? How is it that they just seem to come out with such excellent questions? Preparation. preparation. You know, I could take a line of Shakespeare, out, brief candle, life's but a passing shadow, a player that frets and struts its hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale full of sound and fury, whatever. The tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing. In other words, if you know the words, you don't even have to be a brilliant actor to recite them properly. The reason why top salespeople are top salespeople is because they prepare their questions thoroughly in advance. They think them through thoroughly in advance. And when the time is right, they take the question like an arrow from a quiver and they put it into their bow and they fire it. And it's the perfect question at that time. And the questions are sequenced. Poor salespeople, on the other hand, think, what am I going to say now? They say, I can hardly wait to hear what I have to say. Every sales talk is a new experience for them. It's an adventure in words. But the professionals know where they are. If you ever want to watch a good one of the good old detective stories, like A Few Good Men. Was it A Few Good Men that with Jack Nicholson? Was that the name of the movie? Now, that was some brilliant courtroom scenes because they set the stage and they asked sequential questions in such a way that they were a series of hammer blows, and it made it very, very dramatic. Well, a good lawyer never asks a question that they have not carefully prepared and does not know the answer to. And they ask them in sequence, so there's a logical developmental sequence. So what you do is you just say, I don't know. And if you don't know, you don't know. And wait, if they say, well, how much is this going to cost, and what will this set me back, and what's the approximate price range? Just put it off, as I'll talk to you in a minute. Just say, well, I'll get back to that in a minute. I'll show you exactly. I'll work that out for you exactly in a minute. I'm going to come to that in just a second. But remember, side skirt the price. Because price out of place kills the sale. Price out of place kills the sale. If price emerges into the conversation before you have gone far enough along where you have established rapport, and you have identified the problem clearly, and you have presented the solution, it'll kill the sale. And it's very hard to go back from there. The customer will start to become preoccupied with the price, and it will fall apart. Now, number five is there are three stages of the sale from the customer's perspective. Now we know what you do. Where's the customer coming from? Well, here's what we know. A is recognition of needs is the starting point. Now, Neil Rackham's done some wonderful work on this, interviewing thousands of customers. And what we find is until the customer recognizes that I need what you're selling, the conversation is of no interest to me at all. I sell pills. The pills come in this bottle. It's a beautiful bottle, and they're lovely pills. They're manufactured by one of the finest pharmaceutical companies in the world. I have great pills for you. So what? Did you know that according to your recent medical study, you have an incurable illness and you're going to die within 3 days unless you take one of these pills per hour. For the next 3 days, it'll save your life. Wow! Now I recognize I have a need. I'm interested in what you're talking about. So it's very important when you speak to a customer again, the need may exist and be clear. The need may exist and be unclear. The need may be non-existent. So in your first consulting approach, you're trying to determine which of these three is true for this customer. And don't be afraid to tell them. By the way, the very best sales are when you are upfront with them. You say, Mr. Prospect, in this first conversation, there's always one of three cases. You may have a need for what we sell, and you may not. And you may have a need, and you may not even recognize it yet. And if I could ask you a couple of questions, we could find out which one of these three categories you fit into. Okay. And if you do have a need for it, this could be just tremendous for you, as it has been for many of our other clients. So, recognition of needs is what starts the game. Until the customer has an awareness that I need what you're selling, which means that you have uncovered a problem or a gap that he or she has for which your product is the solution, you're not selling. B is the evolution or the evaluation of options. And what we have found is that you may convince the customer that they need your product or service, and then they may say, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. This has been a very valuable conversation. Leave me the information, and I'll get back to you. And what you did is you just set up the volleyball for someone else to spike it. Why do customers evaluate a range of options once they've decided they need a product or service?
So they can buy it from who they like.
They can buy it from who they like, but also to reduce risk. You see, the greater the number of products that we look at, the more likely it is we'll make a better decision. You all know you're not supposed to buy the first one you see or the first time you go out. And good shoppers are very careful about looking at a variety of options. You may end up buying the first one you spoke to, but not until you have seen what else is available. So here's, we evaluate options by developing one buying criteria. Now, buying criteria are the basis on which you're going to make the decision. If you're looking for homes, one of your buying criteria could be it has a separate bedroom for every member of the family. That's the minimum. A person says, we have this two-bedroom home, and you have two members of your family, so you need three bedrooms minimum. We have a two-bedroom home. It's absolutely beautiful. I'm not interested. It's not even up for consideration. My minimum buying criterion is it must have three bedrooms. So therefore, the best sales are when you make a list of these are the things that are what we call musts. These are the musts, and these are the wants. These are the things that it must have. These are the things I want it to have. And then you begin to look at what's in the marketplace based on your musts. And you get all your musts and as many wants as possible. That's how you make a good decision. Two is order of priority. Once you have determined your buying criteria, you say, of these, which are most important? Which is the most important of all these criteria? Well, you could say you've decided that you want to live in Palo Alto. And so you could say, in terms of a home, the most important of all buying criteria is that I want to live in Palo Alto, near my business, near my family. I don't care if you have the most perfect house and it's located in Walnut Creek. I'm not interested. I want a house that's in Palo Alto within driving distance of my job and my family. Are you with me so far? What are your buying criteria and what is their order of priority? Because not all criteria are of the same importance. And then number three is strengths versus vulnerabilities. When you're selling, you have to say, what are the strengths of your product and what are the vulnerabilities relative to other offerings in the marketplace? Here is a way for you to shift the balance on your in your favor in a competitive selling situation where they can buy from more than one company and you sell different products and services. When you finish your presentation, recognize that most people are going to evaluate other options. They're going to see what else is available. They're going to have someone else phone around and find out if we can get a better deal, a different deal, something else. Here's how you partially lock the deal in on your side. You use these words. You say, Mr. Prospect, I know you're going to look around and you want to get the very best deal and the best terms and the best price and everything else. Good. Don't argue with them or fight with them, because it's very professional to encourage them. If they're going to do it anyway, make a virtue of necessity. Okay? More than encourage them if they're going to do it. It's like people are always saying to, I know people are going to make up their own minds. So when people come to me and say, what should I do? I say, well, you know, you're going to make up your own mind. So you make up your own mind, and whatever it is, I'll go along with it. You know they're going to do it anyway. So you make a virtue of necessity, and they think you're a very wise person. So here are the words you use. You say, Mr. Prospect, by all means, look around. But whatever decision you make, your most important consideration should be whatever your greatest strength is. Let us say your office is across the street. Mr. Prospect, go ahead and make a decision, and we look around. But whatever decision you finally make, remember, your most important consideration should be how close your supplier is to your office. Because that's your area of strength that nobody else has. And that's how you can offset a vulnerability. Mr. Prospect, say yours is more expensive than your competitors. Okay? So you say, Mr. Prospect, your most important consideration should not be price, because price comes and goes, and a few dollars one way or another doesn't matter. The most important consideration should be how comfortable you feel dealing with the company, or how long they've been in business, or what size of market share they have, or what range of services they offer to support. Wherever you're strong, you always say your most important consideration should be this. Then forever after, when they speak to your competitors, they hold your competitors up to a standard where they can't win, because you have already staked out the high ground by telling them this is must be their most important consideration. It's not to say that they will accept what you've said, but it is a very strong thing to do to position yourself well in the comparisons. Number C is resolution of concerns. This is the third part of buying. Once they have decided they needed it, and looked at everything available, and determined how they're going to judge what's available, and selected the one or two, then they have concerns. They're not quite sure yet. And the critical factor in resolving concerns is risk. What if I make a mistake? What's the number one reason people hesitate to buy high tech? Fear of obsolescence. Fear of obsolescence. They're afraid that it will be out of date by the time they get it up and working. And they're right. The flip side of obsolescence is very simple, is that if you buy something that's relatively new, you're going to get your money's worth out of it before it is completely obsoleted anyway. You're going to get 2 to 3 years of running time, and by which time you'll have more than paid it back. So people who hold off buying because they're afraid of obsolescence are not quite accurate. So risk is the critical factor. The critical factor that holds people back from buying is risk. What if I find it cheaper somewhere else? What if it doesn't work? What if you don't service it? What if you don't support it? What if I find something that's better? What if I get criticized for getting it? And so on. So your job is to find out where they perceive there to be a risk and do everything possible to allay it. Number two is your job is to be perceived as the low-risk provider, not the low-price provider. And this is important. If they say, well, yours is more expensive than your competitor that we're looking at, you say, yes, Mr. Prospect, you can always get it cheaper if you're willing to take that kind of a risk. You see, there is a thing in economics, and I've studied economics, as I told you, for years, called psychic value. Do you know what psychic value is? Psychic value is the psychological value of one product as compared to another. And low risk is a psychic value for which people will pay a lot. So don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to point out that yours may be a bit more expensive, but it's a much more secure purchase. When IBM had 80% of the world computer market, they had an ad running continuously in the purchasing managers' magazines and journals, because it was the purchasing managers who made the final decisions for the computers within the companies. And it was, no one ever got fired for specifying IBM. That was a very powerful advertisement, because these people were second-level employees, and they were very concerned about not buying something for the company that caused the wrath of the company to come down on their heads because they made a mistake. They know that if you bought something cheap and it broke down, oh, it would be terrible. So IBM was always more expensive. It was never better, never faster, never newer, never had more innovations than its competitors, but they serviced it and supported it so well that they said, you'll never get fired for specifying IBM. What is a lower-level, middle-level employee concerned about? Are they concerned about job security? The money, it's not their money. Whether they spend more or less, not a penny of that is reflected in their income. The critical thing is my security. So they focused on where the pain was. And people never got fired for specifying IBM, right? Okay, and number three part of resolving concerns is ask. Mr. Prospect, Bill, Susan, I know that you're hesitating, or you seem to be hesitating making a decision. Could I ask why? Don't be afraid to get down face to face with them. They stop returning your phone calls. They won't make a decision. Do everything possible to get face to face and ask for an answer. May I ask why? We've talked a lot. Help me out here. I don't understand why you're hesitating. And often the answer is emotional. Well, I'm not sure. We're not sure. Our people aren't sure, and so on. So a very good question that you ask is, what would have to happen for you to feel comfortable enough to go ahead? What would have to happen for you to feel comfortable enough to go ahead? And if they can articulate, well, if we could just know this, have this, and so on, if they can articulate it, then they would go ahead. I could tell you all kinds of strategies that are fabulous, but the best of all is Xerox. Xerox got into a lot of trouble when their patents all expired and the Japanese came into the market with, and we have friends here from Japanese companies, Konica and Ricoh and Canon and the others. Well, when the Japanese came in with better copiers, faster, cheaper, worked better, and their patents were expired, they just creamed the market. Xerox almost keeled over like a ship flipping in strong seas. And it took them years to recover, but they finally came back with this one solution. They found that the pretty critical concern of a copier buyer is what? Hassle. The damn thing breaks down and you can't get it fixed. It makes people furious. Isn't that true? That's all you hear about all the time. So what Paul Allaire of Xerox said is I'll tell you what, we'll put the machine in and we will either repair it or replace it, and we'll continue doing that until you're totally satisfied without limit. And then he turned to the back to the manufacturer and he said, you better produce a machine that we can make this guarantee with. And within 2 or 3 years, they were winning awards for service excellence from the photocopier industry. Terrible for competitors, but they were really clear. We'll take the hassle out of it. We'll take the risk out of it. We will lower the perception of risk. Okay, number 6, direct relationship between questioning skills and sales success. There's a direct relationship between questioning skills and sales success. The better questions you ask, the more successful you'll be in selling. And so therefore we say this, is the person who asks questions has control. The person who asks questions has control. The more questions you ask, don't talk, ask questions. Gently ask questions. Number 7, keep price in its place. Keep price in its place. When price comes up, and it comes up almost immediately, keep it in its place. Get it back in its place. First, you have to have need. If there's no need, price is irrelevant. There have to be desire. The person must want it, or it's irrelevant. The person must have the authority to buy, or price is not important. And there must be urgency. The person must be willing to make a buying decision. Again, or price is not important. So here's 4 ways that you deal with a price question. How much is it? How much does it cost? That's a good question. That's a good question. Can I come back to that? And just, I call this the brush aside. Just brush it aside gently. That's a good question. Can I come back to that later? Okay. In most cases, I'm going to deal with that thoroughly in just a minute, but I need to ask you a couple of questions first, and then I'll tell you, you know, I'll give you an estimate with accurate within a couple of dollars. Okay. Just deal with it. B is when a person says it costs too much, or we can't afford it, or we can get it cheaper somewhere else, you say, why do you say that? Remember, never argue about price. Always look for the reasons behind price objections. Or C, it costs too much, Mr. Prospect, why do you feel that way? Why do you feel that way? Well, I don't know. I say that to everybody. I will tell you this, by the way. I say, well, how do you feel about the playoffs? How do you feel about the weather? How do you feel about the governor? How do you feel about the climate? How do you feel about Chevrolet cars? People will always answer questions about how they feel because it's easy, because everyone has feelings. So how do I feel about the playoffs? Well, I don't think about them much. How do you feel about the governor? Well, I feel he's doing a good job. How do you feel about the weather? Well, it's pretty hot. You know, in other words, we can always answer feeling questions. Very easy. Think questions are a little bit harder. What do you think about that? Well, give me some time. Yeah. Because think is far more specific. We risk our egos when we think. Anybody can feel without being right or wrong. But thinking has the possibility of being right or wrong. And D, Mr. Prospect, is price your only concern? It costs too much? Is price your only concern? The answer you want is no. You want them to say, no, it's not my only concern. It's one of several concerns. Mr. Prospect, is price more important than service, delivery, backup, support, reputation, guarantee, warranty, and everything in terms? No, those are all important. Oh, good, so price is a major concern, but it's not your only concern. If anybody says to you, by the way, that price is my only concern, I don't care about anything else, all I want is the cheapest, that's it, bottom line. Well, this is not a good customer for you. Your job is not to get into a mud wrestle with people who only care about price. Because people who only care about price get exactly what they deserve. And if all you care about is price, then you're not going to get very much. And your job is, our research shows that your job is not to attempt to be the lowest price provider in your field. It's to be the lowest risk provider, the best deal. By the way, do people want the lowest price? No. Do they want the best deal? Absolutely. In other words, you can always offer people the best price, the best deal, but you don't have to offer them the lowest price. And the best deal is not just the lowest price. It's a combination of everything that's involved. So, 8 is gaining commitment and getting closure. There's all kinds of things with regard to commitment, but people are very scared, very nervous about commitment because there's a possibility of getting a no. And by the way, if you're having problems with the word no, you've picked a very interesting field in which to attempt to earn a living. So, number A is... this is one of the most powerful of all closing techniques. It's called the invitational close. Mr. Prospect, why don't you give it a try? Why don't you give it a try? Why don't you give us a try? Why don't you take it? Why don't you buy it? If you reach the end of the sales conversation and the person seems to have no further objections, you say, why don't you give it a try then? Mr. Prospect, if you have no further questions, why don't you take it? Why don't you give it a try? It's a very easy close and very professional. B, Mr. Prospect, if this makes sense to you, then the next step is. This is called an assumption close or a directive close. Then the next step is. This enables you to keep the initiative and begin talking about what happens now. So if you say, do you have any questions or concerns? And the prospect says, no, you say, well, then the next step is. And you just lead straight into the sale. As if the person says, I'll take it, what happens now? You say, well, the next step is. And you tell them how to buy. By the way, interesting principle. Many customers don't know how to buy your product or service. They haven't bought it before. They don't know how to buy it. And if you don't become aware of that, you can lose the sale. Because the customer will say, let me think about it, because they don't want to admit that they don't know how to buy it. So a very good question, if you even suspect it, is, Mr. Prospect, Mrs. Prospect, have you ever bought one of these before? Have you ever purchased a home before? Have you ever purchased a new photocopier before? Have you ever purchased a cellular telephone before? Have you ever purchased a life insurance policy before? Always ask if they've ever done it before. And sometimes they'll say, well, no, I've never purchased one of these before. Well, you leave it to me, and I'll take care of all the details. Those are the most beautiful words a customer can hear. I'll take care of all the details. I'll take care of all the details. If they like you and they trust you, and you promise to take care of all the details, sometimes that's all she wrote. Okay, I'll take it. If you'll take care of the details, that's fine. It's just quite amazing. Don't worry about it. This is as simple as purchasing a stereo set. It's as simple as arranging for a vacation, draw a parallel. But I'll take care of all the details. Okay, that's fine. Well, okay. So, and the next step is, I'll need a check from you for this. We'll take this back. We'll get it set up. We'll have it out to you in the next couple of days. In other words, just a very gentle close. See, on a scale of 1 to 10, Mr. Prospect, where are we? When the prospect is hesitating, you say, Mr. Prospect, on a scale of 1 to 10, where are we? With 1 being you have no interest in it at all, and 10 being you want to take it this very instant, where would you feel that you are on this scale? Now, the first part of the answer is you want them to be at least above a 5. Of course, if they're at 3 or 2 or 1, not good. But if they're in the mid-range, say 5, I'm at about a 5 or 6, then here's your follow-up question. Mr. Prospect, that's good, that's good. Mr. Prospect, what would have to happen for you to be at a 10? What would have to happen for you to be at a 10? It's a very powerful technique, and often they'll say, well, for me to be at a 10, I would have to know this, have this, see this, be assured of that. Often they will give you what is called the closing condition. And you say, if we could do that or take care of that to your satisfaction, would you be prepared to go ahead right now? Often they'll say, sure. If you could take care of that, sure. If I could speak to someone in my situation who had the same decision to make and went ahead with it and was happy, well, then I'd be okay. If we could satisfy you on that, would you be ready to go ahead right now? Yes, we would. Okay, sit here. Let me call Harry Brown, who is one of our customers in a similar situation to you, and you could talk to him directly on the phone. In other words, you may be able to wrap up a very major sale. I've closed sometimes multi-million dollar sales with some of these very simple ways of asking. In board meetings where the sale was hanging in the balance and they didn't want to close, and I've been able to close the sale and get the check from the controller right there for $3.6 or $3.7 million. I mean, this stuff works. Boy, did I ever go to the bank in a hurry. And the second is, what would it take to satisfy you on that? What would it take to satisfy you on that? What would have to happen? Number nine, your best sources of referrals are your satisfied customers. Your job, by the way, is to create what is called a golden chain. A golden chain is a chain of referrals where one referral leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. You all know the protocol with referrals, don't you? Well, I'll give it to you quickly. First of all, when you ask for a referral, ask for 2 or 3. Mr. Prospect or Mr. Non-Prospect. Would you know of 2 or 3 other people in a similar situation to yours who might be interested in what we just discussed? If they've bought, that's great. But even if they haven't bought, you ask. If you offer 2 or 3, they will come back and choose 2. Well, I know a couple of people who may be interested. If they like you, they'll want to help you. Would you happen to have their telephone numbers handy? Well, a person will almost invariably recommend people whose telephone numbers they have at hand. And then you take them and write their name and number down. And then the third thing you do is, Mr. Prospect, which of these two do you feel I should call on first? They'll pick one of the two, and they say, would you phone him and tell him I'm coming? Now, that's a four-step process. That sounds complicated. It can double your income. I worked with a woman, by the way, in Washington, D.C., a young woman, 26, 27. She was working with, I'm not sure, an office equipment or office supplies or advertising, but she took this little simple formula that I just gave you, and the next time I was there in Washington doing a seminar, she came and she said, I came to your last seminar and did what you said. She said, I started aggressively asking for referrals and then following them up, tracking them. And she said, I made from one customer who did not buy, I made 72 sales in a single year. She said, I have so much business now from referrals, I cannot handle all the business. And the more of it I get, it's the easiest sale that you can make is a referral from someone that the person knows and respects. You're 90%, you got 90% of the sale when you walk in the door, for reasons which we'll talk about later. But she said, it's absolutely amazing. Now, when you do get a referral from someone and you follow up on it, what do you do after you've spoken to the referee? You call back the person who referred the person to you and thank them. Send them a note, send them flowers, send them a fruit basket, send them a book. Do anything to thank them and literally overthank them for having given you the referral. And if you know anyone else who may be interested, I would love to talk to them as well. There are some people who've done this so well that they have literally a network of business associates who stream a river of referrals to them, lists of people. They'll get on the phone and they'll call 10 or 12 of their friends to set up appointments for them, because every time you say thank you to a person, their self-esteem goes up. They get an endorphin hit. They get a nice little feeling like a jolt, like you are their fixer. You are their dealer. And they start to look upon their relationship with you as a very positive experience, because when they deal with you, they get positive responses, and sometimes their friends call back and say, thank you very much for sending me that person. It worked out really well. It's amazing. Here's the rule. A top salesperson is a person who can prospect endlessly, but who never has to, because they have a golden chain of referrals. And the way that you do it is make the decision to develop this golden chain. Number 10 is the easiest resale you can make is to a happy customer. And the business of business is to create and keep a customer. To get resales and referrals is the mark of the superior salesperson. Is to, once you've made a sale to that customer, you sell to them over and over again. Once you've got a referral from that customer, you get more and more referrals, and you piggyback off their referrals, and you piggyback off their referrals, and you keep going like a metastasization in all directions, like a fusion reaction. Does this make sense? Quick story. A fellow was working down here in San Jose, got a job in construction. Started first day working as construction labor. They broke for lunch. They sat down. They opened up their lunch box. They'll open the lunch box. He unwraps his sandwich, and he opens up and says, geez, he says, sardine sandwiches. I hate sardine sandwiches. I hate sardine sandwiches. Makes a big thing of it. What did you get? Cheese, ham, cheese, chicken. Anybody want to trade for sardine sandwiches? Geez, I hate sardine sandwiches. Sits there and eats his lunch. Next day, they sit down all in a row, open up their lunch boxes, unwraps his sandwich, and sardine sandwiches again. Geez, sardine sandwiches. He starts complaining, walking up and down. Anybody want to trade for a sardine sandwich? What have you got there? What? Geez, that's better than mine. Anybody got to back and forth? Nobody says anything. They all eat their lunch. Third day, sitting there, opening it up, opens up his lunch again. Sardine sandwich starts off again. This time the foreman comes up and says, look, Bill, give it a break, will you? You're really disturbing the guys at lunch with all your complaints about your sardine sandwiches. If you don't like sardine sandwiches, for heaven's sakes, tell your wife to make you something different. Wife, he said, I'm not married. I make my own lunch. The rule is that we all make our own lunch, right? And we are complaining. 80% of everything we do is complaining and complaining, and we make our own lunch. We complain about our bills. Who spent the money? We complain about our waistlines. Who ate the food? We complain about our finances. Who blew it all? We complain about our credit card payments. Who's out there spending the damn stuff? I mean, we are making our own lunches and we're complaining. Okay, now, in the action commitment here, we've just talked about some key selling ideas. Open up the action commitment. What one thing are you going to do differently as a result of what we talked about in the last session? Remember, we talked about several things. We talked about defining your product in terms of what it does and how it benefits customers. We talked about determining the major ways that people gain and the major ways they lose by buying or not buying your product. We talked about the three parts of selling and the three stages of the salesperson's perspective. How do you establish rapport? The easiest way to establish rapport is to smile, shake hands, introduce yourself, and thank them for their time. This sounds so obvious, but people sometimes don't do this. Hello, my name is Brian Tracy with ABC Company. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you taking the time to see me. When you say thank you to people, they feel better about themselves. When you recognize that they're busy and you appreciate their time, they're open to spending time with you. Identifying the problem or needs. How do we identify problems or needs? We ask questions. And how do we ask such good questions? Because we have what in advance? We have planned our questions in advance. Exactly. Very important. So maybe one of your action commitments is to write out a series of very good questions and memorize them. In dealing with a customer, remember the customer has to recognize needs before they can proceed. What are the needs that the customer might have that they need to be reminded of or made aware of? They need to evaluate different options. How can you position yourself so you are the chosen option? How can you resolve their concerns? Keeping price in its place. Remember, never overreact to price. Always simply ask, why do you say that? Why do you feel that way? Is price your only concern? Gaining commitment, getting closure. Learning how to ask for the order. Why don't you give it a try? Well, then, the next step is, how far apart are we? On a scale of 1 to 10, where are we? And finally, asking for referrals from every single person we speak to, whether they buy or not. Now, if we can't get an action commitment out of those, we're going to have a serious talk. Having written down your action commitment, then pair off and explain to the person next to you, what one action commitment do you think would be the most helpful to you immediately in increasing your sales? That's great. Now, please understand the reason I ask you to share these ideas is for two or three purposes. It's not just to make this interactive. It is because, as Socrates said, we only learn something by dialoguing about it. And William Buckley wrote recently that we only know something to the degree to which we can explain it to another person. So by dialoguing about a conclusion you've come to, and by explaining it in words to another person so that they understand it, you are vastly more likely to actually engage in the behavior the next time you go out in the field next Monday. So it serves a very, very important purpose of clarifying in your own mind what's important and then reinforcing it into your own subconscious mind, so you're much more likely to use it. Discussing, explaining, dialoguing about these ideas dramatically increases the likelihood that you will use them and they'll become a permanent part of your sales repertoire.
This is the end of this disc. The program continues on the next CD.